Happy Sunday to all my culture members. Today is Sunday, May 2nd. I want to welcome you to another episode of The Culture is Money. This is the second episode. I'd like to thank y'all for listening to the first episode on last week. The various platforms, a few dozen of you took your time out to listen and gave me great feedback. And I want you to know that it's very much appreciated and not taken for granted. I understand that even in a time where people are staying home and they seem to have more free time than ever, that you didn't have to listen and give my thoughts or opinions a try. But the fact that you thought it not robbery, that's the Baptist in me coming out. The fact that you thought it not robbery to take a half hour out your day to listen to my insights and the reason that I was launching this podcast, I very much appreciate it. I'm hoping that you'll listen again, as well as invite some of your friends, your family members, just to give the podcast a try. Of course, I understand it's not going to be every podcast, because every topic may not apply to you. It may be things that you already know. But if you continue to listen every now and then, I would very much appreciate it. Your feedback, of course, is always welcome. And I just appreciate it very much. I went over, I brainstormed throughout the week on various topics I was going to go into, and wondering if I should just jump right into the investing portion of it. But then I remembered to myself that this isn't strictly an investing podcast. It covers the entirety of the culture's money. That's personal finance, money management, investings, and so on. So it dawned on me that during this economic time, when, you know, some people are furloughed, they're laid off or working from home, that I should start with some of the basics, what I like to call hard skills. On social media, a lot, I see people boasting about these soft skills. I know a mantra or narrative that's being pushed right now is, you don't have a money management problem, you have an income problem. I don't believe in that narrative or that type of thinking, because I don't care how much money you make, if you don't have the hard skills of basic money management, you're always going to be living paycheck to paycheck. You're always going to not have enough, and you're never going to know where your money is going. So there are two topics I'm going to cover in our brief time together today. I thought it would be important to talk about emergency funds and the three best places to keep your savings. It's not as easy or as simple as keeping your savings account in your traditional bank or retail bank, as you might think. That's not always the best place to keep your savings or emergency funds, because it doesn't give you the best return on your investment. As well as, I thought we'd go over some money management things, starting with the basics of budgeting, savings, credit and debt analysis, in reference to that type of thing. So I'm going to start with the three best places to keep your savings account. I know during this time, Americans are going through the importance of emergency savings, because you didn't expect this to happen. And traditionally, if the unemployment rate is, let's say, 10% in America, that means the unemployment rate in the culture is almost two times that. So 20% of us could be out of a job when the general population in America is out of work at just 10%. So it's more vital for us culture members to have savings and take this into account, because we're always the ones who take the brunt of any economic downturn, any jobless claims, anything like that. Especially with the government giving you $1,200, I know some of you may need necessities, you may need food, you may need to pay your rent, you know, for the next couple of months to stay in there. But if you happen to still be getting a paycheck, if you happen to don't need the entirety of those financial stimulus checks to go to necessities or anything like that, there are a couple of options I want you to consider putting your money into. The first is a high yield savings account. Now, high is relative today, because savings accounts don't really have an appetizing yielding because the Federal Reserve interest rates have cut so low. Just a personal experience about me. I've always had a savings account in my Federal Credit Union and one in my retail bank. Before I went back to college, this was maybe in 08, 09. I would always put money in both. But I would always see that my credit union savings would always increase more than my traditional retail savings. And that's because mostly over the last dozen years or so, the federal interest rates have been close to zero. Meaning, and for those who don't understand, federal interest rates, the Fed, as you might hear sometimes in the news or on TV or in the paper, the Fed decides the interest rates for which banks and financial institutions can borrow money. That affects how much interest that those financial institutions pay to you because they use your money to lend out. So if the interest rates are low, you're basically getting nothing. So again, now that the interest rates had just started to go up within the last year, you were starting to get a little bit of a yield on your savings account. But now with this economic health pandemic, now they've dropped the interest rates down again. So now you're basically getting nothing. But to counteract that, there are some things that are high yielding savings accounts. For instance, like I said, your local credit union always gives you a better yield. Their interest rates are always a percent or two higher than your traditional retail banks. The reason being, credit unions are not necessarily for profits. You have your Bank of America's, your PNC's, your Wells Fargo's. They're for profit businesses. So their whole objective is to keep as much money as possible while paying you as little. So for them, they don't want to pay you a good interest rates on your savings account because it cuts into their net income for the year and the profits they get to display when they report on Wall Street. Credit unions like MICU or SICU here in Baltimore, or some of you might be more familiar with a national one like Navy Federal, they're not for-profit businesses necessarily. That's why they consider us members as opposed to customers. Because some of these credit unions, as a member, you actually own part of the union. You own part of the banking institution. I know with NICU, when you open a savings or checking account there, $5 when I first opened it was the membership fee for owning that account. And I say all that to say is these are the type of a savings account, high yield savings accounts that you want to look for. Credit unions, and another avenue for that is online banks. Online banks like Chime or Ally, they're are becoming popular, what I like to call fintech companies nowadays. Whereas because they don't have the traditional operating expense such as real estate, they don't have a lot of branches, most of their operations is online, they can afford to give you more of a yield or interest on your savings account because they're not expending that expense elsewhere. And I know some people sometimes are weary of only online institution because what if I have a problem and I'm not getting, you know, through on customer service and all that. You want that face-to-face relationship. I understand that. That's why I'm not telling you to turn your banking completely over to the digital era. But in reference to your savings account, I feel like it's okay because you're not going to be doing a lot of banking with your savings, if you get what I'm saying. Like, your money should just be going there just to save. The most you should be doing is checking to see if your balance increasing, if the transfer went over. So you're not going to need the person-to-person personal relationship that you would traditionally need with a checking account where you might need checks or, you know, you might see fraudulent activity, something like that. So I don't want you to get into the mindset, I don't want to put my money in a digital or online bank only, because what if something goes wrong and I can't get to the bank? I'm only speaking strictly about your savings account. I am a big advocate of having multiple accounts at different banks. That way you're not all invested in one. So the high yield savings accounts, another thing that should make you feel comfortable, these online banks are FDIC insured, just like your regular retail banks, which means that if they happen to go under, all of your money is insured up to $250,000. So you're not going to be at risk of losing your money or anything like that. So you should be fully confident that you're going to get the right amount of money if you ever looking to take it out, that your money is safe in these institutions and anything of that matter. So the advantage of a straight savings account is you're always prepared for economic downturn, you have emergency funds, anything like that. And I also think you should set these up where it's like you have automatic transfers. Don't even depend on yourself to take the money out. In the technology age, you can automatically, soon if you know your payday is every other Thursday, every other Friday, make sure that you transfer, whether it's $25, $50, automatically over to your savings account, wherever you decide to have that. That way you don't have to worry about, did I do it? Or the money's already missing, so you're really not missing anything. Another thing, another high-yielding savings account you should use is money market funds. Now, money market funds are a little bit more complex because these vehicles are kind of like mutual funds, but you're not directly invested in the market because you can still take the money out of the savings account whenever you need it, whatever crisis might arrive, without having to sell anything. These vehicles are designed to be highly stable, and they're invested in cash and short-term debt. You'll also find these at certain banking institutions such as, again, Ally. You'll find them with some credit unions. You'll find them, again, at traditional banks. Now, with the money market, I would feel better with you having these at the traditional banks because they are more equipped to handle the complexities of money market funds, accounts, and savings. Again, they're also FDIC certified insured, so your money will be safe. Theoretically, if they lose value, let's say if they lose value, because back in 2008 when Lehman Brothers went under, a lot of people were invested in money market funds. And they were in fear that they had lost all their money. They may have lost some, but for every account that they had, they got the value of the insured $250,000. Now, I know you might say, Jamal, if I have $1 million, I've lost three quarters. Yes, that's true. That's why you might want to have multiple accounts so that all of your money is not in one account. If I would recommend that if you have $1 million in money, in money market accounts, that you would put literally $250,000 in four separate money market accounts to kind of protect your assets in that way. Another savings vehicle that gives you a higher yield than traditional savings account, I know some of you may be more familiar with it, are CDs. And for those who don't know what CDs are, it's certificates of deposits. While standard savings accounts let you put money in and take it out at will, CDs are not like that. Okay, they're a little different. You deposit a fixed sum for a fixed term, let's call it 12 months, 18 months, 3 years, 5 years. It really depends on what they're offering. And you really can't take the money out unless you want to incur a penalty. Now, that's the potential danger with this. If a emergency does come up and you do need to take the money out of the CD, you're going to incur a penalty at that time. I can't specify what the penalty will be because each bank offers slightly different CDs at different rates at different times, depending on the market, the interest rates, all that. But there will be some penalty that will be incurred. With that in mind, I would recommend that you have a combination of this. I know you're probably thinking, like, so why would I use CDs at all? CDs are still good, but it should be the last resort of your savings vehicles that you tap. Like, I would recommend that you guys have a high-yielding savings account, a money market account, and CDs. I always tell people the more diverse you are in anything, your savings, your investing, your income, the better off you'll be. So I would recommend using the high-yield savings account, the money market savings account, as well as the CDs. Just make sure that the CDs are your last line of defense if emergency does come up. Hopefully no emergency comes up where you have to tap all three or more than one. But if an emergency happened to arrive, that you would be in a position to tap the other ones before going to the CD. And CDs tend to give, again, good yields, better than the traditional savings account. You'll get maybe a percent higher than the whatever the Fed is offering banks on loaning on borrowing money. CDs will always be maybe a percent more high. Let's say if the exchange the interest rate is 50 basis points, which is basically half of a percent. You might find a CD that's at 1.25, you might find one that's at 1.10, you might find one that's a full point at 1.5. It really depends on the financial institution and what they're offering and anything like that. Now, with CDs, again, I would recommend doing some comparison. I'm sorry, I had a whole blank moment for a second. The credit unions are more equipped for that than the retail banks sometimes, again, because of the interest rates on borrowing. The credit unions are better equipped to handle they are more beneficial to you than the traditional retail banks because they're going to give you a higher yield, which is the name of the game. All the information I ever tell you guys is about the system working best for you. And, you know, for so long, the system has gotten over on the culture, and because we didn't know certain information or it was kept from us or we were told, you know, falsity, or we were forced to borrow at higher interest rates than everyone else in the same predicament. But I want to make sure that the information is clear and you know to weigh your options when going into these different financial vehicles. Now, like I said, even with all three of these, I recommend the best approach is a combination. I want you to have as much savings diversity as possible. I want you to use the CDs. I want you to use the money market. And I want you to use the high yield savings. But shop around. I'm not going to recommend one banking institution over another. I will tell you what, you know, has benefited me in certain situations, but everyone's, you know, financial predicament is different. Everyone's fine, you know, financial household runs a little bit, you know, on different wavelengths. So you have to kind of do the due diligence of research. And one thing I'm always going to push to you guys is research. No matter even the information I tell you, it's a based information, but I want you to even check fact me. Go back, because you know some of these banking laws are constantly changing, and though I try to be as up to date as possible, there could be some things that I'm misspeaking. There could be some things that have changed with recent laws, and some state laws are a little bit different. I'm here in Maryland. Banking institutions might operate a little different in California, though overall they have the same foundational banking laws, certain things can be tweaked state to state. So just shop around in regards to, you know, what vehicles you're going to use, who's giving you the best interest, who's giving you the best yield, and make sure that it works best for you. So that's the three savings emergency fund vehicles I would want you to use. If you have any questions on that, please feel free to, you know, find me on Instagram, on Twitter, and send me a message or comment on the various platforms that you listen to this to. And I'll double back in future episodes on certain things to talk into further, or either make some corrections if I find information that has been a little bit inaccurate or needs to be clarified. Just let me know in that regard. So now I want to kind of switch over to the money management portion of it, okay? I know some people sometimes feel that money management, they feel clueless. And sometimes it leads to, like, you know, people not wanting to open their bills because they don't want to deal with the stress and everything like that. I don't believe that's the best approach. The best way to get your financial house in order is to tackle it head on. Taking it from me, like, in my early 20s, I made some, probably the same mistakes as you guys, some irrational, you know, credit card decisions. And for a few years, like, they were either defaulted or, you know, in collections. And I would just avoid opening the bills whenever they came, until I decided that that wasn't a good way to tackle it. Like, every time a bill came, I would just get irritated and, like, throw it away or something like that. And I was like, no, I'm not going to live like this. I'm not going to dread my, you know, dread my mail coming. So I decided to, you know, tackle the issue and head on. And I'm happy to say that I am nearly credit card debt free. I have very little credit card debt. And that has really improved my quality of life because, you know, if your credit utilization is down, then you're able to, you know, get better interest rates on cars and other various factors. And these are the few things I'm about to discuss with you are the methods that I use. The first thing is budgeting. I know people, budget is not a sexy thing. It's very tedious sometimes. It's very taxing because you have to, you know, constantly keep an eye on it and watch it almost like, you know, various times a week. A budget is not something that you make at the beginning of the month and you check it at the end of the month. This should be something you should be checking weekly, at least 2-3 times a week, to make sure that you're on task, or if you're, you know, running over, or if adjustments needs to be made. You know, what most people ask, what is a budget? To me, a budget is assigning, it's basically assigning your money to pay for different things. I made some examples. So I want to dive into a financial example that I said. An example of a budget, let's say you make $2,400 a month. I know some people may make more, some people make less, but I felt like that was a good average, so I'm going to start with that. So your potential budget, and let me say that these numbers aren't I don't want to say realistic, but these aren't a one size fits all numbers, because some of these numbers you're going to be like, where do you find rent like that? And I always find it, when you're giving mathematical examples, keeping it simple is always best, because if people can get the equations or the formulas at the simplistic level, then they themselves can take their own numbers in a more complicated arena and then still do the same thing you did because you kept it simple at the beginning, if that makes sense. Budgeting, like I said, the budget I've signed is $2,400, so I'm going to go down. So let's say your rent was $600. Let's say the insurance was $300, groceries was $200, gas is $100, restaurant out eating is $100, student loan payment. I assume that because of our generation, the millennial, that a lot of us are more college educated than our parents and grandparents. So I included this in the budget because I'm assuming that on average some of us have some type of moderate of student loan debt. So I put that at $200. Household miscellaneous things like, you know, cleaning supplies, toilet paper and all that, I put at $50. Haircut and beauty, I put at $50. Savings. Your savings should also be in your budget as well. That shouldn't be just something that's outside of your budgeting. That has to go into your numbers. I put the savings at $300 and the retirement, whether it be 401k or, 401k should already have come out if your job has a 401k and all that. The 401k, my savings could be either your self-managed traditional RRA, your Roth RRA, or even your investing accounts, brokerage accounts that you may have. I am going to do a podcast on traditional RRAs, Roth RRAs, and 401ks. I'm actually thinking that that'll probably be my next podcast. But the savings should be in your budgeting for your monthly allocation. All totaled, I've accounted for every dollar, every penny in this monthly budget. This is what's called a zero-sum budget or a zero-based budget. With this method, you assign every dollar to an expense so that if you have any money left over, you'll know that it's extra. But traditionally, you shouldn't. You should have even your miscellaneous, or let's say your play money should be accounted for. That should be accounted in your entire budget. That way, you know where your money is going. And I'll tell you again, another personal anecdote. I thought I was good at budgeting until we got into this virus. I've been at home. I know some of you have been at home since March. I've been at home since February. My company kind of jumped on it pretty early just in case. They weren't sure if the pandemic was going to expand, but just in case, they wanted us already set up so we weren't, you know, last minute trying to get everyone adjusted to working from home. So I thought I had a good handle on my budget because I'm not what you would call living paycheck to paycheck, meaning that I had money in my savings and I would have a good portion of a few hundred dollars. I'm talking about not just a couple, I'm talking about $400, $500, $600 sometimes still left over from my check by the time I got paid again. And that's a good feeling, one, but then I realized as I've been home for 60 days plus now that the money that I spend going to work, I really haven't accounted for as meticulously as I should have, because I'm saving a lot more money. And the only really thing that's really changed is I'm not going to work or driving my car to work. So I'm not putting, you know, the gas money in there. So that's adding up. And I'm not eating at work as often as I did. And if I'm being honest, I like to have breakfast and lunch and snacks throughout the day. So that could probably totals up daily. So if I'm being conservative, you can imagine that could easily be $30, $40 a day that I probably wasn't accounting for as much and as meticulously as I should, or I'm telling you guys to. So you learn even as your conditions change or your environment changes that sometimes you need to adjust your budget methods. You thought you were good at tracking your money, but maybe you need to be a little bit tighter. And even with these budget tracking thing, it depends really on your method of work works for you. Some people still like old school pen and paper. If that works for you, that's great. Of course, there's always Excel. If you don't have a computer, a lot of people, if you're listening to this, you have a mobile phone. There are things like Mint or other budget tracking apps that allow you to put your budget in, and they also, which is a very dope thing, they connect to all of your banking accounts and they will track your transactions. Now, they're not always accurate with the labeling of each transaction. So sometimes you may have to go in the app and reassign a miscellaneous purchase to like food or utilities or something like that, because the app sometimes can't always decipher basically based off what the vendor or merchant name is, what this transaction is exactly. But they're very good at tracking and letting you know if you're over budget in one category or under budget in another category. So I recommend using that. Another part of money management that we kind of went over earlier with the savings, but again, it is savings. Now, just to give a brief definition, saving is the process of putting money away for the future. You can think of savings in two categories. There's long-term savings and there's short-term savings. Now, your short-term savings is basically what I was discussing in the previous section, where it's like an emergency fund. An emergency fund of 6 months or a year. I tend to advocate you guys having a year-long emergency fund that would cover all of your expenses. Because traditionally, if something like this happens, where you're either furloughed or let's say you're laid off totally, on average, it takes about 8 to 12 months, just on average, give or take a month or two, to find new employment. So if you have that cushion of a year is a lot, you know, it's a lot more comfortable than 6 months, because 6 months can go by pretty quickly, whereas like a year can go by just as quickly, but it gives you, you know, a longer of a gap. And always longer is more, you know, longer is more comfortable. And I don't think anyone can function their best when they're stressed out about, you know, their emergency funds running out in 2 and 3 months as opposed to 12 months. Now, long-term savings goal might be something including a down payment on a house or retirement. Anything that is longer than 12 months would be considered long-term savings goals. Again, in the various vehicles that you would use, as I spoke on the previous section, you would use them. Again, I cannot stress how much automatic transfers could be helpful in that regard. Make sure that you don't leave it to chance. Just set it up to a point where it's kind of like your taxes. It's like, think of it as paying yourself or your savings first. Have it already set up in whatever banking institution that you have, every 2 weeks on this day, that they automatically transfer that money out of your account. And if they're pretty good, they'll subtract it from your balance. That way, you're not looking at a too much of a discrepancy of what is actually available and how much you have to work with. A goal, I would say, is a goal is to try to save at the beginning 5 to 10%. I don't want to put a exact number on it because, again, I don't know everyone's financial situation, but 5 to 10% seems reasonable. If you can stretch it more, by all means, please do. But something is better than nothing. And if you get the right savings account, as I told you, with these high yielding ones, with these credit unions that give you a nice little bit of a cushion, that'll help you save, because that's free money as well. Think of it as another way. Think of it, I want you to think about when I told you guys about 401ks and your company's contributions. Think about the interest in these savings account as free money. The bank is basically paying you for allowing them to hold your money, use it as a vehicle for leverage to lend to someone else, and they're paying you for that, you know, that capability. So think about it like that. The next thing in regards to money management I want to talk about is credit and debt. These, to me, are like the two cornerstones of money management, personal finance, however you want to label it. Because you have to be able to manage your credit and your debt on top of your money. Because credit is basically a report on your trustworthiness to borrow money. If lenders are going to offer you money, they need to know that, A, you're capable of paying it back, 2, that you're trustworthy, and 3, that you're not a defaulter. I've seen people who have $100,000 in debt but have 750 credit scores because their bills are paid on time. But I've had people who have $10,000 in credit card debt, but their score is 580 because their payments are always late. They're 60, 30, 90 days backed up in, you know, in repayments or paying on time. You got to be able to manage those things. So your debt is basically your debt to income ratio. Like, you want to make sure that you're not over leveraged. You never want to borrow more money than you need to be. Credit and taking on debt should actually be your last vehicle of use. Like, I know some people like to use their credit cards to pay their, you know, their rent, their car notes, and monthly. But they do it in a smart way, whereas if they're trying to, let's say your credit card offers you a lot of rewards points for daily use and everything, basically what they do is they use the credit card to pay that bill or whatever that, you know, the installment is, but they turn around right around and use the money that they would have used to pay the credit card right off. That's a smart way to do it if that's what you're going to do. But I don't recommend that you use credit cards on things like car payments and rent if you're going to let the balance roll over. There are certain ways to work the system where it's beneficial to you. Again, there'll be a podcast where I'll go into the art of working, you know, the rewards points and credit cards and all that. But just for a simple basis of this conversation, you want to manage your credit as great as possible. A good credit utilization is 30% and under. That means if you have 5 credit cards open and you got a $1,000 limit on all, you should have no outstanding balance bigger than $300 on each credit card. And I want to be clear, I'm not advocating, less is always more. Just because typically it's good if you have credit utilization 30 and under, don't push it up to 30. Don't spend $300 on each credit card. It's just, if I'm being truthful, I would like you to keep it somewhere between 15 and 20. Keep it in that range. That always gives you a cushion. That way, if an emergency ever comes up and you're cash stretched and you can't get the funds out of your savings accounts and all that, and credit card is the last of the last options, you'll have that wiggle room to make those payments while not affecting your credit score drastically from it going from, let's say, 15% to 30, then it going from 30 to 60, that is a drastic hit to your credit score. We're talking about maybe tens of points, dozens of points, 60 or 80 points. Your credit utilization is a big part of your credit score. If I can remember off the top of my head, it's definitely maybe 30 to 35%. Now, when it comes to types of credit, there are two types. They're installment loans and revolving credits. And I've talked to you guys about both. Installment loans are what you think they are, like student loans, something fixed at an amount, or even mortgage. A mortgage would be an installment loan. Revolving credit is exactly what it sounds like. Those are your department store credit cards, your credit cards, those types of things. So just be mindful of your credit management in regards to how it affects your ability to be flexible, your ability to handle tight financial crunches quickly, and your credit score. Your credit score is essential. If you don't know what your credit score is, you're entitled to three free credit scores from each of the three bureaus a year. So that's Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian. Each one of them are required to send you a free credit score, a free credit report a year. That means everything that has ever been on your credit history, they're required to send you that at least once a year. They're not going to do it unless you request it, but you get at least one free one once a year. You can also use their apps. They've digitized, so you can also use their apps to get your credit score monthly. But in regards to getting the whole full report, they're definitely required by federal regulations to give you a free credit report once a year. I recommend doing it at various points, maybe doing it January, maybe doing it after tax season or anything like that, just to see what your credit history is like. That is another key component of money management and personal finance. You have to know what's on your credit score, because sometimes 5 to 10% of the stuff reported is inaccurate. And most people don't know because they've never looked at their credit score or their credit report. So things that may be affecting your credit score 10, 20, 30 points go unchallenged when they really should be removed. And I know people like, 10, 20 points don't sound a lot. That is the difference between a percentage higher or lower on a car loan or a credit card interest or anything like that. It is vitally important. A average good credit score is 700. An excellent credit score is anything over 750 up to 820. Traditionally, I feel like just to be okay in a moderate, you definitely want to be in that 700. The lowest I would say you want to be is that 680. Anything 680 and up, you're pretty much in good business. So if you're not and you feel like you need some financial improvement in your credit score, I would tackle that before trying to get any new credit, you know, loans or credit installments put on your credit. The last thing I want to talk about in regards to personal finance, which is probably one of the main things you guys are going to want me to talk about, is investing. You know, investing sometimes is probably the most complicated of all personal financing vehicles. And not to say that you can't understand it, but it's not a one trick or 1 hour conversation. A lot of times when people hit me on various social media platforms, they're like, okay, can you explain this to me? And I'm like, I can give you a quick and dirty what the basis is it, but this isn't a one-off conversation. This is several conversations because what I tell you now might need to be adjusted in a month depending on what the market does or what's being reported or how the economy is, what employment is. There are various things that go into investing. But I wanted to talk about what the various investing vehicles are. Stocks are one investing vehicles, and I know people only think of the stock market as just that, but there are also mutual funds, which is like a basket of different stocks. There's also ETFs, which are the same, kind of sort of the same as mutual funds. They're also a basket of ETFs, but the difference between mutual funds and ETFs is ETFs can be traded just like stock, individual stocks, whereas mutual funds can't. Again, that'll be something we dive in more into in later episodes. There are also bonds, options, future contracts, commodities like gold, oil. I don't know if you guys have seen the stock market over the last 2 weeks, but late in April, the oil market tanked because people were owning what was called future oil contracts. And the way that, just to give you a small indication on this, the way that oil contracts work, that if you don't sell them by the time of the date of delivery, you owning that contract literally means you're going to get that physical commodity. It doesn't just pertain to oil. We're talking about grain, we're talking about copper. You're owning the actual asset for the future, but eventually, if you don't sell it, you're going to have to take delivery of this commodity. And what happened was, because the economy is in such a unfamiliar territory, a lot of people owning those contracts were still owning the oil. And because a lot of us are still in the house in a stay-in-place order, gas isn't being burnt or or bought at as usual a pace, there was no storage capacity. So they had to dump the oil contracts so that they would not get physical delivery of this oil. I say that only to say is like, say, I don't want you guys buying things when you start investing. I don't want you buying things that you don't understand. Imagine owning a futures oil contract, say it's May now, and you bought one for July and you forget about it. Let's say you forget about it. Because you don't understand the dynamics of exactly what you bought, you're going to wake up to 20 barrels of oil outside your house looking like, what has happened to my life? So when it comes to investing, it is not a simple conversation. It is a very complex thing that can be learned. Don't get me wrong, but it's going to take some discipline. It's going to take some devotion. It's going to take some you know, some multiple conversations, some reading of some books, some commitment to the, you know, the grind and the art of learning each thing that you want to learn. And it is completely possible as long as you're committed to that end result. That is all I had written for you guys today. So just to recap, we started off talking about the three places I want you to stash your emergency funds, which are high yielding a savings account, money market accounts, or CDs. Remember that CDs are the most restrictive of the three, whereas when you're one, you're depositing a minimum amount. It's not like money markets or savings account where you may not have a minimum amount. Some savings accounts, it may be as low as $25, something like that. But with CDs, it may oftentimes be at least $2,500, and they are locked in for whatever the time frame is, whether it be 6, 12, 18, 2 years, 24 months. That is the most restrictive, but they are all good, and I would prefer for you to use a mixed approach when starting your savings process. On the flip side, on the money management, we've gone over budgeting being a key cornerstone of you getting prepared to tackle everything in your financial life. Budget, if you're able to budget, you'll be able to save, you'll be able to invest because you have a disciplined approach to your money management. We went over savings again and the difference between long-term and short-term. We also tackled debt and credit, you know, credit utilization, your debt to income ratio. And we also went over the different vehicles of investing that we're going to tackle in the coming weeks. Ashley, I think you guys will be excited. Some of you have been asking me lately, especially with the coronavirus having us home, and some companies have suspended their contribution to their employees' 401ks temporarily. Our next podcast next week will be on 401ks, traditional ROAs, and Roth ROAs. I've been getting a lot of questions on that, not just recently, but over the last few months. People have asked me, you know, just often, should they invest? How does 401ks work? How does Roth or RRAs work? How does traditional RRAs work? So I'm going to tackle that very much in depth. That's the entirety of our conversation on next week. I appreciate you guys listening to me again. If you're a returning customer, I appreciate it very much. I hope you stick around for the long term. If you're a first-time listener, I appreciate you taking the time out. If you guys want to reach me, you can reach me on Twitter at Leo Grand Prince, spelled exactly the way it is. You can also reach me on Instagram the same way, or you can reach me or message me on Facebook or on LinkedIn at Jamal Vitose. That is spelled JamalVetose. I appreciate you guys listening again, and this has been episode 2.